las folias.
At paragraph 96 of your evidence in chief, if you just quickly refer to that.
96?
Yes. So yes. In that paragraph, you mention a particular deemed permit which has a high priority under the deemed permit regime, giving it a high reliability of supply. Do I take it from that paragraph that you have an understanding of the deemed permit priority regime?
Yes.
And then, just sticking with the Manihirakia, over at paragraph 107 of your evidence. You refer there to more than 100 permits being due for replacement by October. So all those permits are deemed permits?
I would say the majority, like over 90%.
Over 90%. So we're talking at least 90 deemed permits. And again, to your knowledge, do many of those have priorities, conditions in them?
They will all be somewhere in the priority list. Doesn't this, you know, they may be well down the priority or at the top, it just depends for each one.
Okay. And the Manahirakia catchment is quite a complicated catchment. We've heard evidence about that.
Yes.
There's lots of tributaries and subcatchments and races taking water from one subcatchment to another subcatchment.
Yeah, and from the Tyree to the Manahirakia, and from the Manahirakia to the Tyree and stuff like that. Yeah.
So thinking about this in terms of priorities on deemed permits, do you have knowledge of people continuing to exercise priorities?
Yes.
Could you perhaps talk about, what would be an example where a priority is still being exercised? Can you think of a subcatchment where that would apply?
In anywhere in Otago or?
Just, because we're talking about the Manahirakia, because we've established that you have lots of knowledge of the Manahirakia.
Yeah.
In that catchment?
Yes, there's priorities being exercised in both Thompson's and Lauder Creek. They continue to operate their priority.
So Thompson's Creek and Lauder Creek?
Yes.
Do you... Lauder.
Oh, Lauder.
Okay. So that's L-A-U-D-E-R.
Yeah, I know what it is. Thank you.
Are you aware of populations of non-diadromous galaxids in either of those catchments?
Both, yes.
Both. And are you aware of whether the exercise of priorities affects those populations of non-diadromous galaxids?
It's a two-pronged thing, actually, in my view. It's both priorities, but also how water is used.
Yep.
So with a lot of the water use in the Manahirakia still being, until recently, flood irrigation and border dike irrigation, they would have quite a bit of return flow to streams or encourage groundwater seepage back to those streams. And in those locations is where galaxies tend to be.
So when you're talking about return, would that be perhaps bywash?
It could be bywash and just overland flow returning to the stream, and also because with flood irrigation you put so much water on and it goes through the ground, it ends up coming back in, like almost like springs down the system.
So in some respects it's almost a form of aquifer recharge almost.
Yes.
Okay. And You told us in your qualifications that you have ecology qualifications.
Yes.
And in your expert opinion, do you consider that these practices are assisting the habitat of non-diadromous galaxids in those catchments?
I have serious concerns that some of those practices have changed in the last 2 to 3 years, which has changed the hydrology, which is putting those populations at serious risk, yes.
And because we're in the Manahirakia, we would be talking about Central Otago round here?
Yes.
If we have a controlled activity which allows for the priorities to be continued to be exercised, would that enable the persistence of those populations?
Not necessarily. My concern is that over the last decade, we've had a plan that has explicitly asked for efficiency upgrades. And consent holders have been given the message from the Regional Council that if it's not efficient use, it won't be granted. The plan expects that. It is also expected that on renewals, with that efficient use, there would be residual and minimum flows applied to protect in-stream values. These catchments have had the change to efficient use, especially in Thompson's Creek, which has drying up those streams that are so important for galaxies, but there will be no residual flows in those catchments under the controlled activity rule to provide for the values that are there.
So, just to be clear, I understood the last answer to pertain to two different time periods, and I'm just needing to be clear for the record.
Yes.
I understood you to say that these catchments are now responding to change in the way that either in response to provisions within the water plan or alternatively administration of the water plan demanding improvement in efficiencies with current irrigation abstraction. So that was one time period, is that correct? The other time period,
yeah,
being this plan change. So two time periods were bound up in that answer. Could you just clarify that?
Yeah,
is critical. Actually critical, yeah.
So right up until, say, about 2010, we had a lot of border dike and flood irrigation in the Manahirakia and a lot of Central Otago. The water plan explicitly requires that allocation is not just actual use, but efficient use, which is based on those aquilink guidelines, which is spray irrigation. People have been, through the messaging from the Regional Council for the last decade, have been shifting from those inefficient methods to spray, and most rapidly, probably since about 2015, in anticipation for consent renewals to show that they're efficient, they're using their water efficiently and that kind of thing. Up until, say, recently, those streams that I mentioned, like Thompson's Creek and Lauder Creek, which have these Galaxia species, have always flowed in summer because of returns from those inefficient methods. From 2018, those creeks dried up for the first time that we know of in at least 30 years. So those populations, recently, a month ago, we did surveys in Thompson's Creek where DOC had previously identified 8 subpopulations of Galaxias recently. We've lost 2 of those from the monitoring that we've done. And they're in those areas that historically gained flow from those irrigation methods. So with those changes, I don't think we've seen the full extent of the loss of those flows in those lower streams. And I think over the next 4 or 5 years, it'll become more and more apparent in the flow record, especially if there's no controls on residual flows.
Why do you think there's no controls on residual flows? Is that under the water plan, PCC, or this plan, or both?
Well, there's no conditions to roll over under the controlled activity to keep flows under the plan change 7 unless there's an existing minimum residual flow condition. In the applications that we've made, we've proposed residual and minimum flows on all takes to provide, especially for non-migratory galaxids, under the operative plan.
Understood. Thank you. Sorry.
Looking at paragraph 110 of your evidence, and in that paragraph you're discussing the applications in the Manahira Care catchment, is that right?
Yes.
And in that paragraph you refer to having shearing regimes prioritising flows for the health of the waterways.
Yeah, so should I explain how, why we do that and how we do that?
Yeah, I'm really interested in this answer. I just want to reread the paragraph myself, sorry.
Yeah.
But you keep your thoughts in mind because I'm interested in it. Question and the answer.
So my question is, you talk there about having a shearing, or you actually say there would be no shearing regime, but presumably the contra of that is that there could be shearing regimes prioritising flows for the health of the waterways.
Yeah.
I'd like you to expand a little bit further on what you mean by that.
So this probably goes to your point about priorities. Every catchment that we go into in Central Otago has a flow regime, and that flow regime has either been delivered by the priorities, delivered by some other shearing regime where they don't operate to priorities anymore because there's a benefit, or a regime that has no priorities at all and they don't bother. So, and then we look at the values and where they are in relation to that flow regime. So often we do what we call longitudinal flows down a stream, which in these modified streams, which are, the values are, especially non-migratory galaxids, are very specific to the actual hydrology at that point. So we try to understand that. Then we come in and go, right, we know that we're shifting to different irrigation. We know this flow regime is not going to go forward. We also know that priorities aren't going to go forward. So we work out an ecological flow or a residual flow to try provide for those values, and then on top of that we initiate a new shearing regime with those water users that prioritises that residual flow for the values. So in the case of Thompson's Creek, Lauder Creek and Chaddo Creek, we've done habitat modelling, and we have, because of the compulsory value status under the MPS, we have applied the logic that 100% or optimum flow for those species will be the residual flow in that tributary rather than drying it up. And in that way, we're trying to say that we will minimise the effect on the threatened fish habitat, the compulsory value, due to abstraction. And we've had to work for a number of years to get agreement with those water users that that's the outcome we will try to achieve through the consent renewal process.
Who do you mean by we?
Our team, our technical team and our planning team. So
for the council or for somebody else?
For the Manahira Care Catchment Group.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. So just to capture what I think your answer is to Commissioner Bunting's question, this is work that you have been doing to include in the applications that have gone forward to council, is that right?
Yes, so Manahirikia Catchment Group is the overarching group that represents over 600 water users in the catchment. They have employed myself to run their technical program, and my role is to bring in technical expertise to do hydrology, ecology, water quality. We work with a planning team, a team of experts, or multiple planning teams, to deliver, to try deliver an approach that is far superior to what's happening at the moment.
And down at paragraph 114, you really get to your conclusion on this aspect, don't you?
Yes.
And that's where you talk about how, with the implementation of residual and minimum flows prioritising ecological values, water share agreements are in place to manage how the water that is over and above those for the environmental outcomes is distributed. And that perhaps comes to Mr. Moore's point when he was discussing that with you earlier. But certainly the intention is that those water sharing agreements do provide for, at the very least, the environmental outcome. Is that correct?
Yeah, the aim is, you know, we try to do the best we can with what we can. We know that we don't have council that's got the MPS and what's expected in front of us.
Yeah.
But we know we have an obligation to, if we know something's bad, to fix it. So that's what we've tried to do. And this doesn't take weeks. We've been working on this for years. Years, not... It's very difficult, some of these discussions.
I just want to quickly just cover off with you. You've mentioned a few times compulsory values of the MPS 2020. And do you still have that with you?
Yes.
Okay. If you could just go to page 36 of the MPS. Sorry, I'm not sure quite what the common bundle page is.
Sorry, you want the MPS?
Yes.
Yep. And which are you looking at?
So I'm looking at page 36 of the MPS. I'm sorry, Your Honour, I'm not sure what the common bundle
That's
page
okay.
number is.
Just, sorry? You got the...
700, apparently.
No. Yeah, have you got the document in front of you?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, sorry.
Yep. And just to clarify, so when you're talking about the compulsory values, you're meaning these compulsory values in Appendix 1A of the NPS?
Yeah, so we've tried to address ecosystem health, threatened species and Mahinga Kai species, and human contact where we can, where we know irrigation runoff or bad practices affecting E. coli. We've specifically targeting fixing that, but ecosystem health, obviously with the ecological modelling and stuff that we've done, the threatened species is clear at Central Otago Roundheads in the lower part, and species D or Clutha Flatheads in other parts of the catchment. And then for Mahinga Kai, we've tried to target tuna habitat in our recommendations.
All right, thank you. I have no further questions, Your Honour.
Thank you. I'm winging it because I haven't got the email from... who's next? You next, OK.
Give me please.
Sorry, I don't think I've got an activate schedule in front of me.
I just want to pick up on a theme from Ms Williams in respect of the state of knowledge about what's happened recently and then in the preceding 15 years about non-migratory galaxids. And you referred a lot to the Thompson's Creek scenario. Mm. Now, I understand not just in relation to the consent applications, but there's also this exemplar catchment grant, if you like, and I understand you've had some involvement
yes.
in that.
Yes.
Perhaps could you give us a rundown of what that was and what's been approved by central government in that regard?
So, was it late last or mid last year? MFE called for projects to improve water quality and ecological outcomes. So on behalf of MCG, I put an application into the ministry for Thompson's Creek, specifically because of this problem for Galaxis and water quality. So as part of that project, myself and regional council staff, some consultants, Fishing Game, DOC, have all worked doing surveys throughout the catchment to identify where these populations are and are now working on how to implement barriers and stuff to stop trout or perch getting into those populations and further removing them. But we've also got a constructed wetland likely to go in what we call the sluice channel, which is the major tributary of Thompson's Creek, where historically most of the flood irrigation occurred. And that used to bring a lot of sediment, DRP and E. coli, down Thompson's Creek and into the main stem of the Munhuri Ker. So I've been working on that with NIWA and some engineers around constructing a wetland that will put water through it and hopefully clean up some of that water quality issue for Thompson's Creek, but also for contact recreation and stuff in the main stem.
And so that's a community initiative that's separate from the consenting process, isn't it?
Yeah, that came about from some work that Beef and Lamb had contracted myself and Dr. Olson to do around water quality and why water quality was so poor and how to fix that. And so we went in, took about two samples to work out why it was so poor, and then we instigated an approach to fix that. And yeah, MCG support that, and Thompson's Creek sub-catchment group are part of that. And yeah, and now MFE's effectively taken it over through the exemplar catchment process.
And how does that relationship between MFE and the community team that you referred to, do you get given a resource to spend on research and works?
The initial grant was for $500,000 to do wetlands, culverts, fencing and willow removal, and surveys and design the wetlands and stuff like that. So we have a catchment coordinator who links between MFE and myself and the rest of the stakeholders that have been working on that.
Yep. Yeah. And just going back to that Galaxid research, have you got a time frame for when you're aiming to have answers or plan action plans, or you know, what's the end game for that part of the work stream?
I'm hoping that Mr. Pete Ravenscroft got to do some work there on Saturday to finish on the main stem of Thompson's Creek, where the Galaxis population runs out, and then it's a matter of putting a proposal to the minister, and if the minister pushes go, then we will do that. But we already have two or three small populations where we know all we need is a perch culvert to keep other species out, but we've still got to get the resource consent from the council to do that, and we still need the resource consents to build the wetland. Mm-hmm. So who knows how long that will take, but
yep.
That's the plan, is running faster mm-hmm. than anything I've seen for a long time to actually do something about water quality or species interactions, I guess.
Yeah, okay. And just going back to that water quality point, and if you can't tell me, that's fine, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but you said it was pretty obvious what the source was of a particular degraded site. Was that related to an activity that was permitted under the plan, or one that wasn't perhaps being done quite in accordance with the rules?
Well, given I'm in an environment court, do I really want to throw some people under the bus?
No, I don't think you do. You might recall there was a...
Sanitise.
Yeah, sanitise it as much as you need to.
The activities that were taking place would be prosecutable under the regional plan and would not meet the NPS guidelines. Some of the other stuff would have been captured under Plan Change 6A if it was operative now.
Right.
And hadn't been postponed.
Right. That's what I was more interested in, is that integration.
Yep.
That land water integration.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you didn't need a degree in freshwater science to know what was going wrong.
Right. 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 Thank you. And that was really interesting how you explained when the change from border dike and flood irrigation changed what's, well, there's at least a correlation between that change in practice and flows that are being observed in the imported streams for non-migratory galaxids. Did, when in those situations where you made those observations, when the farms were changing to the more efficient infrastructure, presumably they were still taking a similar amount of water but irrigating a larger area with it?
Not necessarily.
But in some cases that would have been the case if
there is some cases where expansion has occurred, but in other cases people downgrade because of their reliability. So you might have a big volume of water, but it's not necessarily reliable, so you end up coming down and doing that really well, say with a pivot, rather than doing twice as much, just throwing it on. So yeah, there is shifts both ways, so I acknowledge that it can go like you say, but and the return flow thing is evident across a few catchments where those methods were used. And even in the lower Manhirikia now, what used to come back and bump up the flows at the bottom by Alexandra has meant now is not happening, so there's more water being released from storage to accommodate that transition. And it makes it really hard to know what status quo is. Like when people in here are saying, oh, status quo is going to be all right, and in 6 to 10 years' time it'll be the same, we'll pick the pieces up then, I don't think they actually know what they're talking about, to be honest.
Even the status quo is actually dynamic, isn't
it? Yeah.
Yeah. Mr. Swan from Forest and Bird asked me to ask a couple of questions. So were you here when he was asking Dr. Hayes questions about...
No, I wasn't.
No, so he put to Dr. Hayes that, you know, over the in this issue of trout access and predation, put to Dr. Hayes that, you know, trout have been here 400 years, and over that time there will be, you know, weather patterns and floods and periods of higher flow where trout access upstream or downstream to the populations of non-migratory galaxids would be possible from time to time. Have you got a view on that proposition?
I guess it depends on timing. Like, are trout actually looking to move when those flows occurred? And from what my experience tends to be that... it's not necessarily if there's trout in there or not, it's how strong that trout population is. So if they can every year they're getting knocked back, so there's only 4 or 5 trout, then the galaxis can survive and they don't, it doesn't matter. But when you get a population, say you've got 100 trout in that zone, then eventually they will dominate and take over. So these really tough flow regimes that have historically occurred basically crop the trout population because they can't handle the high temperatures or the low dissolved oxygen, and they get knocked over, or the majority do, allowing these galaxies to persist. So it's more than just can they get there, it's can they actually survive there and then grow to a size where they're going to actually impact on that population.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that Dr. Hayes said is it also depends on if the habitat gives the galaxids refuge to hide from the trout, even if they are there, like small side braids or boulders or vegetation, on riparian vegetation. So is that another factor that helps the galaxids not be predated upon completely?
I would say it's more habitat that trout don't like. So we often find galaxis in what braided, riffle, open habitat because trout don't like to be in there in those little streams. Trout tend to prefer deeper pools, and so you can end up with a wee bit of separation, and as flows drop, you often end up with more riffle kind of habitat than pools. So it favours them in that way. So it's not necessarily that they can hide, it's just that they don't cross over as much, and then you're providing very little habitat that trout prefer compared to what galaxis can survive in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Now, just moving on to hydrology, and you've got a series of paragraphs where you're, you know, and this is obviously, or I'll ask you this question, your understanding of the state of the hydrological data that we've got to work with in Otago, that's not just based on your recent work with consent applicants, and it's that's based on your long time with the regional council as well?
Yeah, as well, yeah.
Yeah. So your paragraph, like, it's from paragraph 22 onwards, basically leading up to your table 2, which is after your paragraph 37.
Sorry, what was the first paragraph?
22.
Yeah.
You say that there is significant amounts of reliable data across multiple aspects, and you can, and obviously you concede that some don't have much data at all.
Yeah.
Then at 31, you agree with Mr. Henderson that where there is gaps, it can be supplemented with modelling. Then at 35, you again confirm there will be adequate hydrological data available. And then at your 37, you show three examples of three catchments we're all familiar with of the existing information that is available for those catchments. And one of those lines, as you'll know, is a line that Fish and Game has been interested in for their case, which is whether or not naturalised flow records are available in order to determine what naturalised mean annual low flow is.
Yep.
So you're of the view, and similar to the regional council, that there is sufficient information available to make that determination of what naturalised MELF is.
As good as we can.
Mm.
Yeah.
Good. Yep. Good enough for the job.
Yep.
Yep. Then at your paragraph 41, you've summarised what you've appended, which is the information requirement technical guide from the regional council.
Yes.
And at A, that also makes it clear that the regional council's expectation is that naturalised flows be part of that information package that an applicant provides.
Yeah, I can't think of an application that I've prepared work for that we haven't tried to do naturalised with observed and then have that discussion.
Mm.
Yep.
So in terms of, you'll be familiar with the table that Dr. Hayes recommends in terms of minimum flow and allocation expressed as a percentage of mean annual low flow?
Yes, I...
Perhaps if we could get Dr. Hayes' evidence for Ms. Dickey. So if you go to page 7 of Dr. Hayes' evidence,
yep.
And as you probably realise, in part, Dr. Hayes based this in part on some of the recommendations in the draft National Environmental Standard.
Yeah, it looks familiar.
Yeah, it looks familiar because you were involved in that
yes.
that process as well, weren't you? You were one of the members of the working group.
Yeah, and then I reviewed it as well.
And you reviewed it as well.
Technical.
And one of the tables that we got taken through last week in that draft document is the relationship of degree of hydrological alteration and total abstraction expressed as a percentage of MELF. So you're familiar with this concept?
Yes.
So looking at the allocation rate row, which is sort of the row that corresponds to the work that was done for the draft NES, with 20%, 30%, 15% or 10% of MELF as the abstraction, do you agree that that's either a medium or a high degree of hydrological alteration in accordance with the the thresholds
set
in the draft NES.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was recommended to be the trigger for different comprehensiveness, the different level of comprehensive assessment of effects depending on the degree of hydrological alteration.
And the values.
And the values, that's right.
Yeah, so they're like a gateway or a screening kind of process to, if you were to exceed this, you have to do more work to assess the effects properly.
And based on, you know, your experience since you were involved in that draft NES, do you still see that conceptually as an appropriate trigger for that gateway or that screening decision point?
Yeah, where we can, we try to apply that. So in most cases under Plan Change 7, you would fail this screening process, almost every catchment actually, based on probably the allocation rate as a percent. I'm not sure what Malfi's used, whether it's observed or naturalised, but he doesn't say.
I can clarify that it is meant to be naturalised.
So I think what this would mean is that every consent that's under Plan Change 7 would require more information. Actually screen anything out. It just says you're all going down this pathway of lots of work and lots of assessment.
I was going to put you, Dr. Hayes' summary to you as well, Mr. Hickey, but perhaps I'll just read out the sentence. But from Mr. Hayes, Dr. Hayes, paragraph 6, the way he puts it is that those limits set a presumptive standard on the basis that it is likely there will be adverse effects over time if abstraction from a river exceeds those limits. So do you agree with that as summing up how those standards...
Where was that, sorry?
That's in his summary, sorry, paragraph 6. I don't know where the summary statement for Dr. Hayes is.
Clean copy. I would have written all over mine. You got a clean copy?
No, sorry.
No clean copy. We'll have a record somewhere.
There we go. Miss Irving's got a copy.
All right. Thank you.
I'll see you, Irving.
Thank you.
Thank you. So paragraph 6. Thanks. So I just, because it's important to understand your view on this statement as well, Mr. Hickey, the third sentence, the limits set a presumptive standard on the basis it is likely there will be adverse effects over time if abstraction from a river exceeds those limits. So do you agree with that statement?
I think it's a wee bit too presumptive. Like, I can think of ways that you would manage with more allocation or a different flow that may not necessarily have severe effects.
I guess you'd get there with the further assessment, so wouldn't you?
Yeah. So conceptually, if that's your benchmark for doing more work to get beyond those numbers, that's fine. That's often how we look at things, you know, from a quick assessment of a mouth and the flow and the values, and you automatically know if you're in a high risk or low risk category.
Okay, thank you. Now, just turning to your paragraph 65. And your second sentence, you say, in most cases, reducing water allocation for irrigation will not improve the outcome for the compulsory values under the NPS, and in some cases may make things worse for some threatened Indigenous species without other interventions.
Yes.
Now, your qualification without other interventions, is that just in relation to the threatened species point?
Yes.
Okay, so let's put that aside. And I just wanted to look at the other compulsory values of the NPS, which I think you were just looking at with Ms. Williams.
Can I also read this paragraph again before you ask the next question?
Thank you. So the first compulsory value is ecosystem health. And is it your position that if there is less water taken from the river, that's not going to improve ecosystem health?
Well, it depends when it's taken, and it depends on what your measure is of ecosystem health, and whether it's the water being taken that's creating the degraded attribute, or whether it's something else. So, for example, Upper Manharikia has Didimo. Didimo causes an issue with periphyton attribute and also MCI attribute. If you assume that leaving more water in is going to improve those two attribute outcomes, it won't, because you've still got Didimo. So it's not always as simple as more water is better for an ecosystem outcome.
No, but that's quite different to saying there will be no improvement, isn't it, if there's more water?
Well, maybe
which
I've gone a wee bit too far in that, but what I'm trying to say really is that don't assume all the time that taking allocation away is going to materially improve the outcome you expect to see. You need to understand, especially in modified systems with introduced fish, introduced didimo, damming and all that kind of stuff, it becomes quite hard to drive home what the actual problem is.
Yeah. So does that better explanation, if we look at the second compulsory value, human contact, what you're saying is don't assume just because there's more water in the river you can go swimming there because it might still be contaminated.
Yeah, if there's still an effluent discharge from the town upstream, probably doesn't matter if you put more water back.
So. Okay, all right. Well, I understand that statement now. In your paragraph 63... And what I want to move on to look at now is the relevance of the Te Mana o Te Wai priorities, the three priorities, and the different, I guess, reference points from which we need to assess those to understand how they're going to be achieved. And already you've quite helpfully educated probably most of us that there's no such thing as one status quo as a reference point. That could be a dynamic reference point, so
yes,
that's something we have learned for starters. But what you'll be aware of is that there is also the reference point of the naturalised state being another relevant reference point.
Do we want to do this again?
Well, just a little bit. If you think about the first priority of Te Mana o Te Wai and protecting the health and well-being of freshwater ecosystems, to properly assess that, don't we need to understand what the original, to the extent we can, what the original state of the health and well-being of a water body was?
I think it's useful to know. Yep. So I agree. It's good to know that, and then you can work out the deviation from that, if there is any, how much it was. Yep.
So you thought it was easy.
Yeah. If you stop there, it'd be good.
Yeah. Well, I've got no further questions, Your Honour. Honestly, you haven't. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. Re-examination.
Ms. Baker Galloway asked you about Dr. Hayes's evidence and concerning observed or naturalised mouth. Were you in court when Dr. Hayes gave his evidence?
No.
All right. Well, in answer to questions, I think, from Mr. Moore, or it might have been from the court, I can't remember, but in any case, he explained that you calculate a seven-day mouth by looking at flow records for the river, and in each season, finding the 7 days with the least flow, the lowest flow.
Yes.
And then you average that over the course of the record. Does that ring any bells to you as a method for calculating 7 day mouth?
Yeah, so you sum them and then average them.
Yes.
Over the term of record.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, if you follow that method, is that observed mouth or naturalised mouth?
Well, it depends where your flow recorder is. So if you're at the bottom of the Manhuri Kea, it would be an observed mouth. If you were in the headwaters of the Tauri in the Canadian Flat, it would be a naturalised mouth or natural mouth. So,
if we apply Dr. Hayes's method to his Table 3 on page 43 of his evidence, which is the one taken from the draft National Environmental Standard. Do you have Dr. Hayes's evidence available?
Yeah, that's it. Yes, I've got it.
Do you remember that table from the draft NES?
I feel like it's different.
Oh, I see. Well, in any case, and if you don't know the answer to this question, just say so. Do you know whether he's talking about observed or naturalised mouth in any of those references in the table?
No, that's why I asked the question, because normally you would say observed seven-day mouth or naturalised seven-day mouth.
I see. Now, lastly, on that table, do the thresholds of change that are referred to, the values that are given there, take account of whether there is storage in the catchment?
I don't know. I'm not sure if he's talking about run of the river allocation or storage.
No.
Allocation.
So for a catchment where there is a large body of storage, let's say for example the Tauri with the Loganburn Reservoir at its head, is it possible that observed mouth might actually be higher than naturalised mouth, higher in the catchment?
When there's augmentation from storage, there's potential for... Yeah, there is potential for that.
Yes. And so if naturalised mouth was the only metric where you are seeking to understand the significance of change in a flow regime, you might miss the benefits of flow augmentation from storage.
Yeah, potentially.
Nothing further, Mark.
Just for my benefit, could you define observed mouth? How do you define that?
So, effectively, it's the same process of taking the lowest 7 days of each year, the average flow over that 7 days, and then doing it for every year of the record, and then summing those and then averaging them over the full record. But observed mouth is what we consider has been affected by taking is not what would occur if there was no taking upstream of that flow site. And it's often the most challenging part of what we do is trying to naturalise a flow statistic, especially where you've got very complex water use and taking.
So Mr. Page asked you, observed mouth is what you would expect to see at the bottom of the catchment, and you said yes, because that is the consequence, the flow in the river would be the consequence of all taking of surface and connected groundwater.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's your output is what you actually see.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's you can calculate that as an observed mouth. And whereas the naturalised flows, I'm not quite sure whether he might have been talking about Manahita Care, but I don't suppose it matters actually. Is the naturalised mouth is something that we're using somewhere other than at the bottom of the catchment. And he might have said top or he might have said middle, but I wasn't quite sure. But anyway, I was just wondering your definition of naturalised mouth. It's not observed mouth?
No. So my definition of naturalised would be adding in back the water that was taken out to get the natural mouth. Naturalised mouth.
Okay. Cool. That was easy. So I figure that you're a witness that probably knows heaps about priorities because of who your firm represents.
I have had a bit of experience with priorities.
A bit of experience, okay. Anyway, I was really interested in your evidence that changes to hydrological flows, which I would include surface water and connected groundwater, are a consequence, at least over the last 10 years, of improvements in irrigation efficiency. Because of improvements in irrigation efficiency has seen reduced, overland flow to surface water body and reduced recharge to groundwater. Correct?
Yes, yep, exactly.
And that change in flow has altered the physical habitat, which otherwise was being provided through abstraction patterns prior to any significant change in irrigation methods or infrastructure in response to efficiency. Correct?
Yes.
I think you were asked, but I may have picked it up wrong, whether those change in hydrological flows in the last 10 years were as a consequence of anything to do with priorities. I think you were asked that, and I think you said no. Do you recall something about that?
Yeah, so listening to a lot of the evidence and reading a lot of the evidence, there is the assumption that priorities have driven the flow regime to maintain indigenous fish or threatened fish. And in some cases this is true, but in my experience it's actually the water use that came from the water takes that often drives where those fish are because of the inefficient use and inefficiency of it and the returns, as you pointed out. So it's kind of a horses for courses. Some catchments, it will be the overriding priorities and the way they run it. Other catchments, it will be the return flows. And when we've done quite a few catchments and assessments, you learn pretty quickly not to assume what's on paper is what you're going to get in the reality of Central Otago, if that makes sense.
Okay. Okay. And so then a question for several parties, but not necessarily all parties, is an important question of how those priorities are to be reflected in the provisions of the plan and consequently any, you know, resource consent. And I think your answer is that for some catchments, those priorities may be a controlling factor in hydrological flow and related physical habitat. But in other catchments, it is not a controlling factor or the controlling factor, that there are other controlling factors to do with the use of water.
I think the way I would... If I assume the value is there because of the status quo,
and
I would
want... value being like...
Non-migratory galaxies.
Okay, right.
Then I would want to know what that flow regime is specifically at that point. I would not just assume that because on paper those deemed permits have a priority, that that is what's driven that outcome. So when people say the status quo, we're happy with the status quo and it's going to be fine for the next 6 to 10 years, so therefore we can live with it, I would challenge that, have they even defined what that status quo is, and have they actually tested it against the provisions of what they're proposing for the outcome? It would be dangerous to just assume that status quo is what I think it is, or what it says here in paper must be happening out there.
Therefore, it's a rebuttable presumption that the replication of priorities are indeed resulting in a benefit to the environment, and including in particular the galaxids.
Yeah, I wouldn't assume that. No.
You wouldn't assume that. It can be rebutted. It may be the case, but it may not be the case.
Yes.
All right. Okay. Just pulling back a lot to understand our priorities. In your experience, are applicants for resource consents applying to, you know, either for a new permit or for a replacement permit and saying, and please, can I have a condition that acknowledges my existing priority? So that must be because they're deemed permits. So the better question is probably for replacement consents for deemed permits. Do they go in and say, please, can I have my priority back?
No.
No. Why don't they do that?
Because they worked within their catchment or sub-catchment and negotiate a sharing regime, which then gives them a collective buy-in to the environmental flow, allows you to manage the recession of flows. But in Central Otago, in my experience, the most important thing it does is gives certainty over what will happen if we get into a dry event. That you're not fighting and scrapping. You know how you're going to have to manage your property because it will get dry in Central. So once they have that certainty, then they can... The loss of reliability or security from implementing the environmental flow is often then put into a longer-term plan of putting in storage to the volume that you would have had access when you dried the river up is then taken at higher flows and put into storage a lot of the time now on farm storage. So it gives an ability to adapt to that if you've got that security, and that's what the sharing regimes do.
Is everyone who has a deemed permit in every catchment on a flow sharing agreement? Or is it the case, and again you can only speak from your experience, that of those persons who hold deemed permits, the majority or 50% or only some of them are on flow sharing agreements? So I'm trying to get a sense of how sort of ubiquitous, universal are these flow sharing agreements, particularly for catchments dominated by deemed permits?
So at the moment, Tairi catchment voluntary shares. They have a sharing agreement. We've been, myself and Ms Susie McKeague, who's given evidence, are contracted by those water users to roster them so that they don't fight with each other. It's easier for us to call them off than them to call each other off.
Interesting. you roster deemed permit holders. I'll come back to that. But anyway, Tairi.
Manhuri Kia already have a sharing regime, but we have formalised that through the consent application, so the whole catchment will work together to deliver both sub-catchment and main stem flows in their application. Lindis catchment, full-on sharing regime. Luggett Creek catchment, sharing regime. Cadrona, I would expect they are already a water group and work together, but they haven't gone right through the process, but they will water share. Trying to think. It's more common than not, in my view. For the non-deemed permit catchments, like the Kakanui, which is part of Plan Change 7, they've had formal water sharing for at least 20 years with telemetry, and they're endorsed by council. Almost every catchment or sub-catchment we work with, we do a sharing regime, whether it's between two people or 600. It's kind of you have to when you're dealing with the allocation levels we're dealing with and delivering a flow together at the bottom of a catchment.
Now, you said you and another person are... I'm not quite sure whether you were rostered to stop squabbles or fights breaking out or... But, you know, again, that's interesting insofar as your role in the Tairi catchment, flow sharing, supporting the flow sharing arrangements there... with a view to the flow sharing arrangements specifically being for a purpose for delivering flow to abstractors for their use on farm, is its primary purpose as opposed to delivering or ensuring flows remain in the river for some other environmental outcome. And again, I'm trying to get a sense as to what this thing is. Because,
so the primary purpose is to not breach minimum flow.
So primary purpose not to breach the minimum flow.
Yep. And then secondary purpose is to share the available water over and above that and reduce conflict.
Just press a second.
And the Tairi is a good example of my status quo logic. At the moment, we have deemed permits that don't have to adhere to that minimum flow at all.
Mm.
And if you assume that's the status quo, because that's what the permit says, and they have priority, you'll be wrong, because they have been operating at least 4 or 5 years voluntary outside of the deemed permit, what it says they can do to ensure they don't breach the minimum flow. Actually knowing each river and each catchment, what's actually happening, is very important.
All right, so the primary purpose is to ensure that resource consent holders don't breach a minimum flow, and the secondary purpose to ensure that water users all abstractors have a share of the water above the minimum flow, and thirdly, to reduce conflict as between abstractors. Have I captured that
correctly?
Yeah,
I think that's fair.
And it's on the minimum flow. flows, it's not residual flows.
No, this.
And it's not cessation of tape.
So the Tauri is really around the minimum flows. Mm. In catchments, in the Manurikia on some of the tributaries, we'll be instigating shearing to provide for those tributary values as well as the main stem. So depending on the catchment and the scale of the taking, the shearing regimes can be at a catchment scale or a sub-catchment scale, or they can build right through to the whole lot. And yeah, the take cessation stuff, I don't really take much notice of those, to tell you the truth. There's not that many. They're kind of, I think they're, when they're referred to, they're around this consent must stop for that consent. Is that, we're normally just dealing with residual and minimum flows. You just stop and leave that water in the river, and I don't see those take and cessation consents having much environmental benefit at all. Yeah, residuals and minimum flows, definitely.
Tributaries and
yep.
Side streams and things, is that right?
Sorry.
Is that what you're telling me?
I didn't quite.
Residual flows often in relation to the tributaries and side smaller.
Well, minimum flows tend to be on the main stems, and the residual flows tend to be on the tributaries. Most of the deemed permits in Otago are on tributaries. So, and most of the high value compulsory values are in the tributaries, so you get the biggest bang for your buck is protecting those tributaries. So
when you were talking about minimum flows, were you also meaning to wrap into that residual flows
when
you were answering the primary purpose?
Yeah, definitely. Sorry, I missed that. Yep. And that was the paragraph that Mr. Page used in his opening submission, where he referred to my evidence, was around you've got to get some water in these creeks if you're going to look after these valleys, because at the moment they're getting dewatered. All the water's coming out. There is no requirement to leave water in them.
Mm. And I don't want to get sidetracked, but I understood your evidence to be that the dewatering is a consequence of efficiency gains with irrigation.
There's two. One consequence is they take all the water because there is no cessation or no residual flow or minimum flow condition to prevent it, and that's most of them, 90%+ of them.
So no minimum flow, no residual flow?
Nothing at all.
And that's 90% of what?
Of the deemed permits.
Of deemed permits, okay. Yeah. Okay.
At least probably 90%.
Yeah.
And then, so what, like, on Thompson's Creek, what can happen is the deemed permit at the top, which has high priority, takes everything, dewaters the stream, it goes out the races, they use the water, and then that water comes back in further down the catchment where these galaxias are. But now that return water is not coming back like it was, and will probably reduce more over the next 5 years. But they're still taking all the water out at the top as well. And that won't change under what's proposed.
Is everyone on the scheme? The schemes?
Yes.
No outliers.
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Okay, you said two causes for dewatering. One is that for 90% of the deemed permits, there is no minimum or residual flow. And so there is, particularly in the upper part of the catchment or bed, I guess a main stem, but more particularly tribs, there's no restriction on the take relative to a minimum flow or trip.
Nope.
Understand that that water, if you like, was delivered back to the catchment lower down via surface water recharge or groundwater recharge to a connected groundwater system, to a connected surface water system. But that's not happening so much now.
So they're the two.
Improvement efficiencies. So those are the two related.
They're the two primary reasons.
All right. Just pause there a second. Okay, and for those catchments that where there is a large number of deemed permits without residual or minimum flows, or catchments where the residual or minimum flow regime, at least under Schedule 2 of the plan, is not applied. Nevertheless, there may be flow sharing agreements, as I understand your evidence.
Yes.
And those, and the purpose of the flow sharing agreements in those catchments, what is it?
Well, if we step back 3 or 4 years in Otago, we knew October 2021 was coming. So we've been trialling flow sharing and residual flows and streams leading up to this point. So we've been, we would put together a flow regime and a sharing regime, but often we would get pushback from the water users that they wouldn't work or that it wasn't viable, and so we would test them. And so some of the flows that people have seen in the last 2 years, and they may think that that's what status quo is not. They're actually well beyond what the permit status quo would deliver. So, yes.
So just expand on that. Why, when you say some people might think that's the status quo, but it's not.
Because...
Are you talking about farmers here?
Stakeholders, farmers, other, just ORC. General public, ORC.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So, for instance, the Manhurikia, yeah. The Dunstan Creek, the biggest tributary, we have been trialling flow at the bottom of the creek to not dry it up. And if you think that that's what you would get out of no residual flows and priority systems, that wouldn't be what they would see. So they might have this perception that it's going to be okay for the next 6 years because that's what we've seen it like for the last two. But it's not necessarily what's going to happen.
But again, returning back to the purpose of the flow sharing regime, particularly in catchments with no minimum flows or residual flows, what is its purpose? Or does it depend on the catchment, what its purpose is?
Well, generally it's to provide for ecological values, as so far as we can determine, and in general, first priority is the compulsory values under the NPSFM.
So it's generally not to regulate access to water.
No.
As between water users.
No, it's about providing for the ecological outcome for that stream, and then over and above that, we manage the access to the water for the users. So we don't set a flow to deliver water to a user as such or anything like that.
Yeah.
But we expect a cooperative approach to deliver the outcome for that tributary or river.
Now, these flow sharing agreements, have you cited them?
Yes.
Yep, okay. To enter into a flow sharing agreement, What do you have to do? What do you have to do? Is it signing a piece of paper? Is it giving up money? Is it what is it? What sort of agreement is this thing? What creature is this thing?
Generally involves a lot of lawyers.
Oh, right.
So they're legal agreements, fully... Yeah.
So it's a binding agreement as between everybody, all parties to that agreement.
Yeah. And often it'll go along with a company or a group, and they will fund... They share the costs of those things. They share costs for the compliance and the monitoring and all that kind of stuff. So they become quite formal groups, and the sharing agreement is often the basis of that group. But they're very explicit about how much water you will get, that your obligations to the environment or to the flow that you have to manage to?
And do they explicitly make it clear that the parties involved aren't going to basically rely or try and exercise their priorities?
They often
is that a part of it?
Fundamentally give up their priorities to implement this new regime. There's very... I can't think of any that I've dealt with where the priorities have remained.
Because it would be inconsistent with the outcomes for the scheme for any one individual with a higher priority to maintain that higher priority against lower priority individuals.
And you might not be able to deliver the environmental outcome that's necessary if that priority was to stay where it is. So the priority one gets to take everything. No one else gets a say, environment or anything. So effectively you're saying priority one is now environment, and priority one shifts to priority two, but everyone's at priority two now. It's quite a different approach.
So when these agreements are signed, there's no notification to the regional council or anything like that.
No.
These priorities are now basically...
Well, the new permits don't have...
In terms of their legal status.
Yeah, the new permits that come with this new regime don't have priorities on them. So they'll become RMA consents with no priorities.
Yeah, that's the new consents, but you've talked a lot about these voluntary arrangements.
So these are all on the premise that they will go on, that'll be the new regime as part of the new consent. So at the moment,
at that time, the new consent rolls around, priorities are gone.
Yeah, because at the moment, if a deemed permit stuffs up and takes all the water out by accident, council can't touch them. But after they've got the new permit, they can't afford to have a mistake anymore. So it's a good time to trial something because there's low risk of getting prosecuted or making a blunder and it getting held over you. So that's what's been happening the last few years.
Okay. So is it your evidence that recent consenting decisions by the ORC have recognised and imposed somehow as a condition of consent flow sharing arrangements or agreements?
Some have. Definitely the Lindis thing had flow sharing on it, imposed.
How does that work? Like, you know, yeah, how does that work? Where, I mean, the Lindis was, you know, a large group application for the catchment, but how does it... Well, it can only work if you've got all members, I guess, of the flow sharing arrangement or agreement before the council.
Most of the groups we don't do very many individual consents.
No.
So we do mostly groups. So we do it all in that group. I mean, yeah, there is, it's pretty obvious there's some social license now to abstracting water and irrigating. And these guys aren't silly. They know that if they're going to breach minimum flows in the Tory, everyone in Dunedin's going to have a crack at them. So there's that kind of pressure to start working together. And then they all live in the same community, so there's a pressure not to do wrong by your neighbours and your local community. So it all kind of builds with that. And then once you've got it all in place, those groups often expand into dealing with other issues around water quality or... becomes a vehicle really to do more. So in my view, I'd be doing everything I can to encourage those sharing agreements, working together, resolving those things for future, kind of addressing other issues and catchments.
Do you want to go first?
You
can have a different timing situation.
Yeah, we...
And so you can have a whole lot that are being dealt with now in terms of things that need resource consent with the deemed permits and the ones that are due to expire soon, and then you can have a whole lot of other ones that have been issued over a longer, much longer period of time, and that aren't necessary in the tent in the terms of the process that you're following, for example, for the Mangaruru Care, for example. So how do you deal with those ones that are outside the tent? I guess the regional council could maybe review some of these things, could they?
Yeah, in the Tauri there's always been the expectation of a review. Once everyone's in the tent, do the review, formalise the whole lot. So that is expected. It's always been expected to happen. Some of it we just haven't had time to get to either. Like, we've got so many deemed permits, so many catchments in now, that we haven't been able to fully dedicate. There's not enough people to do these regimes and work them out. And I really don't want to have to do it all again in 6 years' time across 600 permits or whatever the number is now. It's tedious and time consuming and difficult.
Yeah. That may be so. time consuming and difficult. It's not the benefit of recognising that work effort today in this plan change now, because that's where I'm interested to learn why this has not been brought forward as a more appropriate tool than priorities or minimum flows or residual flows, even where they are imposed. Is not the benefit of that approach now, taking that approach now, that you're driving, even over the short term, improvement in the environment? That is, you're halting degradation, if not improving or reversing the trend towards those degrading values, which Mr. Page identifies are the attribute values in Schedule 2 of the NPS.
I fundamentally think we should be making improvements where we can, immediately.
So then, is it more sense, in your view, to look at bringing forward into this plan flow sharing agreements, even as a matter of consideration somehow, but to bring forward into this plan the flow sharing agreement, than it is to bring forward their priorities?
That would make more sense to me for future-proofing it. A lot of this work is around security and being able to move forward and do these things and work together, and it's encouraging that. That's the bit that I worry that a lot of the messaging through this plan changes, that don't worry, you don't expect to have any water, don't expect to be irrigating, don't expect anything. And it's hard to encourage someone to work into those groups and work on good environmental outcomes when the messaging is quite scary, I guess.
Mm. Well, I don't know who delivers those messages. But really, I'm just trying to understand whether from your perspective, and I think the answer to this is yes, that you would encourage consideration of those flow sharing arrangements or agreements prior or in preference to priorities, correct?
Yes, I would prefer to have that going forward than priorities.
Yeah.
And on the premise that the sharing has been done to deliver the environmental outcome.
Yeah.
There's not much point sharing if you're not leaving any water in the river.
Is the sharing operating now?
In some cases, yes, sharing. But in some cases, the flows haven't been put right forward or haven't been completely cemented.
Is that also on the premise that the sharing is delivering environmental outcomes which at least over the next 6 years will improve the baseline environment going into the new land and water plan. Would that be a fair assumption? That
I think it's a no-brainer.
It's a no-brainer. You'd get deliverables over the next 6 years.
If you implement residual minimum flows and shearing, you're going to improve the environment.
Right. And is it a no-brainer that if you improve the environment over the next 6 years, that that is a better place to start from when looking at the land and water plan to come?
Well, it follows, doesn't it? The only thing is, and I is around the implementation that's needed to make those flows happen. And is 6 years going to be good enough to do that, or do you need to be thinking a longer term, but not 35 years based on what everyone's saying, but knowing that you're going to be bringing like an iterative change process, is there an ability to do that and secure those gains? I don't know. That's
the question for the court, is whether the consenting process drives the iterative change, or does the plan the plan to come under the NPS, you know, the new plan, drive the iterative change?
Or does the first iteration of the change come from the consent process, and then you mop it up behind with the...
And that's a possibility, but it's a probability, something to be... because the consents are expiring, and I reckon people want water for some term at least. All right. Questions?
Yes, you were asked a question about water quality.
Yes.
And I didn't fully comprehend your answer, so I just wanted to be clear about that and you find it. You said that consideration was all delayed, and I didn't know what you meant by that in terms of water quality.
Where did I say that?
I think you were being asked a question about Kiuta Te Kai in terms of the connections between land use and water quality and water quantity. So I had two questions. I wanted to understand what you meant by it all being delayed, and then I wanted to follow up with a question to ask you about all these applications that you're involved in on a catchment basis, and you know, the Manuhiruha Care may be one example, but there may be others, and I was wanting to know whether... as part of that, you were factoring in water quality.
Okay.
So two questions.
So there was Plan Change 6A that was commonly referred to in Otago that brought in discharge limits for water quality that were supposed to become operative in March 2020, I think. But they were then subject to a plan change which delays them till 2025 or 2026?
2026, actually. It's coming back to me. I think we were taken through that by you, Ms. Baker-Galloway, to annotate the version of the plan that we actually had. So thank you for reminding me about that. So in relation to my second question then...
So those discharge limits, because I helped develop them for the Regional Council when I worked there, the timing was to be ahead of where we are right now, because we knew in Central Otago that a lot of the issue for water quality was irrigation runoff water, wipe off water. And so the theory was that if they know in 2020, before they get their new permit for irrigation, that if they're failing those water quality limits, then they would have to change their infrastructure and the way they're using water to stop that happening. So that was the point of those discharge limits and the timing, and specifically targeting the things that we know have impacts on water quality in Central Otago. With regard to how we've addressed the water quality stuff, and Manahiri Care is a good example, we are talking about converting spray to get rid of those overland flow issues and things like that, better management of that sort of stuff, increasing the flow left in streams. Rather than having wipe-off water recharging the bottom of tributaries and running out into the river, leaving high-quality water from the top past takes to run through the creeks and contribute to the main stems. So get rid of that runoff and leave better water and hopefully make improvements. So Dr. Olson, who I think will be presenting evidence, will be able to be more specific around the water quality stuff. I've kind of left him to deal with water quality in the catchments that we've dealt with, but in principle we have tried to address water quality where we can, as far as we can, where we know that there's a hot spot or a problem.
Thank you.
Any of these further examination of the consequence of the court's questions?
No.
I think, Mr. Page is sitting. He's remained seated. So, thank you very much for your words.
Thank you.
Very helpful responses, I think, in terms of understanding priorities and the relationships with flow. So, I'm grateful for your evidence. Yeah, and you're free to go.
Thank you very much.
I think that's us. Back here with you, Mr. Page, 9:30 tomorrow to finish off those subs.
There we go.
As you would have heard from this witness, the court is very interested in what can be built around the flow sharing agreements
very
as
morning.
Another method of management rather than whacking in priorities. Yep. Ms. Dixon.
Sorry, Your Honour. Tomorrow morning,
yes.
Mr. Rensor is here.
Joining her first.
Sorry?
Oh, no. Oh, sorry. We have to let Mr. Page finish his case because that's kind of just finish his opening. He's only halfway through it. And then his witness took over.
Yes, I realise what's happened. We do have some availability issues, though, with Mr. Ensor tomorrow morning. He's basically here for the morning, and after that he has to be away.
That's fine. Mr. Page hasn't got too much to go. I'm going to let Mr. Page finish, actually. Mr. Ensor will have to come back a different day, but Mr. Page should be able to finish his opening.
Thank you
for letting me know. I don't have any particular order for tomorrow. Mr. Ensor wants to go first. We're fine with that. Yep, as the first witness. Okay. Anything else? Mr. Moore? Okay, good. All right, we're adjourned for the night. All right.